I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
It's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again. You've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
But we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, Ben, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, introducing Dr. Simon Floth. He is an Australian analytical philosopher who's lectured in metaphysics and logic at the University of New England and is currently researching on religion. He was an early contributor to WikiLeaks, refining the vision and experimenting in collaborative analysis. Since 2004, various independent sites have featured his political articles, including at antiwar.com. We ran this one last week, Assange's Ecuadorian Cave. Welcome to the show. How's it going, Simon?
I'm going very well. Thank you very much for having me.
Very happy to have you here, and very happy to have the opportunity to have published this article here, a very important piece about Julian Assange, founder of WikiLeaks, and his current predicament there. As we know, he's been locked up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, in Great Britain there for how long now?
It's been 6 years since he's been under detainment of one form or another. Actually, no, 6 years since he entered the embassy, that's right. It's been about 8 years since he had some sort of detention. So in 2012, he entered the embassy. And the anniversary of that was just a few days ago, as I understand.
Mm-hmm. And now, so it's a bit complicated. We all know what he's really doing there is hiding out from the USA. But can you go back and explain a little bit about the never quite charges in Sweden and the rest of the story here and what he's doing in there?
There was a media frenzy after it was presented in the Swedish newspapers that Julian Assange was wanted for sexual assault. That was back in 2010. And curiously, just after release of the Iraq war logs. Apparently that was illegal. The newspaper released that it was leaked from the police, and that's contrary to Swedish law. They're not supposed to do that. The police aren't supposed to do that, but somehow it happened. What happened then, the case was dropped almost as soon as that news came out anyway. The Swedish prosecutor, once they got the report from the police, said that there was nothing substantial in it, and it was shut down. And some of the details are lost just from my memory, but it's the main stuff still stands out pretty clearly. The case was taken up again by members of a political party that has a very strong feminist overtones, and the charges were upgraded, and the word rape was used, at least in English, and there were, nonetheless, both of the women had, one of them said explicitly in a report that I read in a paper, that it wasn't rape and that she wasn't afraid of Julian, he just has some issues with women. And the other woman had complained in the police reports, which you can see online, that she'd been railroaded and she didn't want to accuse Julian of anything at all. They just wanted to see what they could do with help from the police to get in to take a test for sexually transmitted diseases. Mm-hmm.
Well, and now, so this is pretty important, right, is these two women, they went to the police, they basically just wanted, you know, they made a mountain out of a molehill in the first place. In the middle of this guy being the most wanted journalist on the face of the earth, they decided that they were what mattered. And because he had, I guess, decided to you know, take a condom off in the middle of an act with one of them or something, that they wanted to have the cops basically force him or ask him to take some kind of STD test. They didn't even want him charged with sexual assault in the first place. But the Swedish government, at the behest really of the Americans and the Brits, they trumped up the charges into a rape case. Is that pretty much right?
That's exactly how I would say it. Yeah, that's what happened. There was nothing, really no substance. Every time they tried to push a detail on the issue to try and check and validate a claim, it just turned into nothing. It was never pursued either. He asked if he could go to the UK because he wanted to do a presentation, and they said, sure, off you go. And he left, and then they raised the alarm and put out an arrest warrant just for the drama, I suppose. And then, of course, we all know what happened. The British police arrested him, and he's been in detainment ever since.
Mm-hmm. And so it was when he was out on bail, he got in a cab and snuck over to the Ecuadorian embassy and was able to score asylum there. I had forgot. I did not realize it was 6 years ago.
It's been a long time.
Mm-hmm. And now, so the case in Sweden is completely canceled and gone now, correct?
Yeah.
I mean, for years they were saying they wanted to question him, but they wouldn't come to England to question him. They were demanding that he give himself up to the Brits and have the Brits transfer him over to Sweden in custody just so they could question him.
Yeah. There was all this nonsense about him being the reason. They were saying the reason he wasn't charged technically was that he had to be present in Sweden before they could press charges. And this was a really obscure and incoherent point of semantics that that dragged out the case. And they did actually say at one point that they were legally unable to go to interviewing in the UK. Mm-hmm. And that was complete nonsense. It had been done before. And not only that, but they eventually did go and interview him in the UK. And then eventually, once they finally did interview him, it was very shortly after that they dropped the charges.
Oh, okay. So I didn't realize that they had actually gone through with it, and they finally did relent and give in and question him there at the embassy. And then that was when... And when was that they finally did go and interview him?
I don't have the date. I do assume it was 2017, okay. Perhaps 2016. I think 2017.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So sometime relatively recent there. But so now the problem is for the audience keeping up, first of all, nobody's playing down actual sexual assault. It's just that that's not what happened here, right? This was a pretext. And as you said, Simon, the women both, you know, backed way down and backpedaled far from actual assault here. But then, so the thing is, why is he still in the embassy if the Swedes have dropped the charges? I guess the Brits still have a warrant out for him skipping bail. But then there's another real reason, right? And that is the Americans.
Well, it seems like there's just no other way to analyze the situation. There's a warrant for skipping bail. Like, what's the significance of that? The only reason that he skipped bail was to seek political asylum. That's been absolutely validated. The UN has ruled that he's been... improperly detained and should be freed and compensated because he was political, you know, that was valid. He was under political persecution from the US, and there was a serious threat to him even back then. Now it's only worse. Now it's much more obvious. But the UK is... It's almost as if they think they have some face to lose or something, and they're just doubling down on the stupidity of it.
Yeah. Well, and so the thing about Julian Assange is he's not an American citizen or a U.S. person. And so I guess the theory that the government is using is that he doesn't count as a foreign, and WikiLeaks doesn't count as a foreign news organization, but... It's an intelligence agency, a non-state intelligence agency, I think was it Hayden or Clapper or one of these kooks called it. And so then their idea is They want to prosecute Julian Assange for espionage, for being a reporter, for publishing leaks that are given to him. He's not a... Espionage would be like breaking in and leaking the documents himself, right? He's a document receiver, just like the New York Times and the Washington Post and the LA Times publish, you know, classified data daily that's leaked to them by government officials. And yet, and we do know this, right, from various post stories in the Washington Post and others, that they have in the past had a grand jury investigating and trying to figure out how to pin a charge on this guy for journalism. We do know from various reports that there has been a grand jury impaneled in Washington, D.C. to try to trump up an espionage charge against Assange for doing journalism, right?
Absolutely. And that's exactly, I did hear you make the point that there's a difference between somebody who goes and acquires information and somebody who publishes it. And the New York Times, like you said, published this information. At least the historical stuff going back to the Iraq war logs and much else from WikiLeaks. It was actually Mike Pompeo who said the thing about Foreign Intelligence Agency. And it's quite ironic coming from him. He was referring to WikiLeaks rather positively during the election because he was a supporter of Trump. And so, you know, you compare his tweets side by side. He's, you know, he's changed his tune along with his job. And it's just really tragic to see that kind of thing coming from the highest levels of power.
Yeah. And by the way, I mean, when it comes to parsing the law here, just to be clear about it, the Americans have never called a grand jury together to investigate and see about indicting any journalists from the London Times or the Daily Telegraph or the Daily Mail or the Australian or any other foreign news agency. Their theory of the case here is an obvious lie. That WikiLeaks is not a journalistic organization, but it's some other thing, but just because they say so. When in fact, the direct comparison to the major newspapers is readily available. Look at who they work with. Who published the war logs? The Guardian. You know?
Absolutely. They just don't have a case. It's you have to go to the most extreme lengths of paranoia, of Cold War hysteria to make any kind of case against Ricky Lacey.
Now, here's the thing about Assange. Well, there's a few things. But one thing that the Post and the Times don't do, I mean, they publish secrets all the time, but they publish secrets that our government wants in the paper, mostly. I mean, they have scoops from time to time. But mostly, the classified information that they present is like, ooh, the Houthis did something bad, and that's why we have to help Saudi bomb them, or something like that, to justify what it is they're doing. Here, WikiLeaks is doing something that... pretty unprecedented, at least going back for many years, in publishing the State Department cables and the Iraq and Afghan war logs, the Guantanamo files, all the rest of the Manning leak, and then a lot of the other stuff that they've leaked about all different countries, not just the United States. They really go and show, you know, massive emails about all what's going on in Somalia or in Russia or with the American State Department or whatever, and they published it in a way for other journalists to do the work writing the stories, and they're publishing the raw data. But so we can understand why, to a State Department official, this is a qualitative difference, right? They're terrified when they see a massive leak like the Manning leak getting posted online like that. They can't stand that. And yet they really don't have an argument about a difference in substance, only in quantity, really, right?
Yeah, I would say that that's true. It's a matter of quantity. It's also a new type of history, you might say, because you've got the original data. You're not just getting a story with little footnotes as to facts here and there. You've got the reality is just laid out there in front of you to research. And that's going to change the world, I think. You know, it's been denied and dismissed as insignificant and irrelevant, but that entirely depends on ignoring it, because everything that's so much as just constantly coming out of it from ongoing research in all areas.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, there's this great manifesto that Assange wrote years ago. And they might try to argue that this makes him something other than a journalist. Although, of course, you know, I don't buy that for a minute. I wouldn't see the follow. All journalists have an agenda. Most journalists' agenda is telling the people what the government wants us to think and know. Okay, great. And a lot of, and then there are a lot of other journalists who have other agendas, like exposing those people in government who would tell us these or those lies. But Assange made his agenda very clear. He said that in the age of this empire, where so much that the government does is illegal and therefore kept secret, that by leaking secrets, it forces government to react in ways inside the bureaucracy with their insider threat programs and all these things that he's actually trying to provoke and force government to clamp down on their secrets internally so hard that they actually become unable to carry out their conspiracies because the information gets bottled up and it can't flow around inside the bureaucracies in a way to, you know, actually help them accomplish their goals. And so more transparency, less tyranny, simple as that. Jam up the works by making them, you know, clamp down and be afraid of what might happen if the truth about what they're doing gets out, which sounds to me pretty much like what journalism is supposed to be, right? But isn't that basically what journalism is supposed to be anyway? He's just really crystallized it there, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe he's done one up in terms of jamming up the works. But that's exactly right. I think what makes WikiLeaks so important is that the media just doesn't do what it's meant to do. It's like a fraud. So the whole point of WikiLeaks was to do something about the fact that, you know, we get lied into a war by Iraq, regarding Iraq, and most wars that have been since and before that were all in the same lines. It was just a bunch of lies. And the journalists just went along with it. The journalists sold it effectively by not being critical, by not doing their job.
Yep.
Now I can't hear you. Yeah, there you are.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, so you're absolutely right, and you know, far too right. It's just tragic. And what's worse is that when something comes along like WikiLeaks, and you know, initially had so much promise, and there was a huge response from the media, like you said, all those major papers publishing the contents of WikiLeaks' leaks, and now they're just turned on him. Because I think they've realized that they have to make a decision whether they're going to follow his model, the proper model, or whether they're going to follow the old model of being in bed with power. And it tragically seems like they're sticking to their bad habits.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, though, I mean, well, we did talk about how he's not a U.S. person, so that complicates it a little bit. But it seems like, you know, for American journalists to refuse to rally around the right of this man to publish this stuff, they are really putting nails in their own coffin here. I mean, if there was ever a case of if they can do it to him, they can do it to you, it's this. And then who's supposed to stop them if the journalists won't? Without the First Amendment, all we have is the Second.
Yeah, you might have a point there. Well, you absolutely have a point with digging their own grave. I think it applies not just in the case of the U.S., though, because in all constitutions in the West, at least in the English-speaking world, it's the right to free expression is paramount. And the U.K. journalists, have been the worst of all. They've been the most cultivated a sport of snidery when it comes to Assange. And they've got a lot to lose as well, because if they're going to sit by and you know, cheerlead the what's going on now with his terrible abuse of his human rights and possibility of extradition, if that goes ahead, what's to stop any of them being extradited or basically coming under the same oppression at home as part of the general, you know, intelligence sharing and strategic and military alliance.
Right. Well, and you know, like you talked about with the journalist betraying him there, a lot of that is partisanship, right? Because when the Manning leak came out, it was during Obama years in 2010 there, and yet it mostly reflected on George W. Bush and his wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, his State Department, Hillary's too, but mostly things that had gone on, you know, earlier in the 21st century there. And so typical kind of center-left liberal reporters had no problem with that. But then when he's publishing stuff that's hurting Her Highness, who, you know, her worshipfulness, who for some reason it was her turn, and Assange was getting in the way of Hillary Clinton's coronation as dear leader, then that was intolerable. And that makes him a Russian agent, and that makes, I guess, Manning a Russian spy too, retroactively, and God knows what. And now they just absolutely hate his guts.
Yeah,
like,
I mean,
in a personal way, right? They've turned on Assange personally. They don't like him anymore because, oh, he's with the right and he's with Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump, they say.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely accurate. And the whole problem with all of this is that it comes down to such petty considerations and, like you say, hatred. And I think that that was clearly the case when it came to the drumming up of the Swedish allegations, because I think John Pilger quoted the Women Against Rape as saying that this was just a really cynical politicization, and that, you know, that the whole idea of accusing Assange of rape on such flimsy grounds was really a demonstration of a misogynistic attitude by people who just want to go about a political persecution.
Yeah. All right. So now the problem here is, to bury the lead a little bit, it's not just that he's locked up in this embassy where, as you say, he was awarded asylum by the previous president of Ecuador, but now he's being terribly mistreated by the current president. They've shut off his internet access and shut him off, you know, basically completely to the world. It's been more than 2 months now. And so you cite here the Mandela rules. I wonder, what exactly are those, and do they apply in this situation? I guess you said that the UN has ruled that his, you know, staying in the embassy is a form of detention there, that it's not just he's made the choice to hole up there, that he's been forced to.
Well, he has the choice between keeping his asylum and leaving and try to get some medical attention, which is an unreasonable choice. That choice has been forced on him by the British government.
And now, is medical attention at issue here right now? He needs some?
Yes, seriously at issue. It's been an issue for a long time. Some doctors had written in The Guardian about the fact that he needs, this was going back years now, he needed MRI scan, which you can't get in the embassy, obviously, for his shoulder. And additionally, I've heard reports of dental issues and sight problems, and an unrelenting cough. He's stuck there, and they're doing everything short of beating him up on a daily basis, basically, to try and squeeze him out and shut him down.
Well, and that's not working, right? I mean, he's not going to give in. But they have been able to succeed in shutting off his access. But so who's doing anything about it? He's got to have a lawyer trying to help him here, right?
Oh, yeah, he's got a legal team on the case. He was, as I pointed out in the article, visited by two Australian officials from the High Commission. And though almost nothing has been said about it, his lawyer, Jennifer Robinson, did mention in a recent, just a couple of days ago, in an interview, that they had made a request for the Australian government to assist by making a formal application, I think it was, to the British government to receive an assurance that he won't be extradited to the US.
Yeah. which the Americans won't. I mean, I guess the Brits won't promise that because they're in on it with the Americans. They do want it extradited. And that's exactly what they're trying to do, right? Again, it's the Washington Post that's confirmed that they do have a grand jury, or at least they did impanel a grand jury to come up with charges against him.
Yeah, there's a lot to support. I think it was actually stated by an intelligence consultant group, H.B. Gary, that there was a sealed indictment already. Mm. That goes back a long time. That goes back several years now. Now, it's difficult to speak for a government in the case of Britain, in this case. I think there's definitely an element of that. There's the alliance with the US. There's the politicians. I would say that if the British people weren't so misled by such an intensely antipathetic British press, then it would be hard to say what the disposition of the British people would be. I think on the whole, really, they would support him. Just from the fact that all he's doing is publishing information, he's holding power to account. That's the function of the press, which the press isn't doing. I think there would be also some general, even in this situation where he has little sympathy from the press and from the people who take it seriously, the press, that is, even in this situation, it's such a major thing to extradite someone to a foreign country to be tried for publication. I think there's a chance that he would still win in the courts. But certainly, if the press climate was a little different, he would be, I think he would be in the clear. And the government would provide the assurance. Even now, I think there could be enough pressure, just with a bit more public awareness, enough pressure to maybe make it happen that he does actually get an assurance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, I like the way you put it in the article here. You say, well, suppose he were not merely an Ecuadorian citizen, but which he is now, right? He's been given asylum. But what if he was born and raised in Ecuador? Then, you know, in other words, forget Assange and his white hair and his James Bond villain role and whatever, the way they portray it on TV. But let's just say he was Joe Reporter from Ecuador. How could anyone justify the way he's being treated, put on house arrest for publishing things? It's crazy.
That's right.
It's illegal.
It's only the fact that there's this gigantic machine spinning a convoluted narrative around the events as they occur and putting out such intense smear campaigns against him. It's only that fact that distorts people's perceptions so much to be unable to see that kind of thing. There's no difference between what Ecuador is doing now and just basically going into his house, putting him under house arrest, cutting his internet connection, not letting him have any visitors, putting a guard outside him. The only difference is that he's in an embassy, which is actually not any person's property. It's the property of the nation of Ecuador. The officials who run that are responsible and have to give it a valid account for what they're doing, and they have to treat him as someone with human rights, as an asylee, as a citizen. And as a publisher, because that's what he is.
Yeah. It's just amazing, denying him health care and all of this stuff. And they don't really have another plan, do they? The Americans and the Brits here, and I guess the Ecuadorians now, deputized by them. Their plan is the status quo from now, you know, indefinitely? Or do you think there's another step that they're planning to take here to figure out? Because this doesn't seem very tenable. Denying him health care and all that looks pretty ugly in Western papers. I mean, if they'd ever publish it.
Absolutely. I think that the whole time they've just been going by the seat of their pants and seeing how much they can get away with. And frankly, I think they've done amazingly well in getting away with things. And it's blown my mind how far the press has been complicit in this and what sort of state of derangement they've gotten themselves into to allow this to keep going. And the problem when you do that is that you get into, you dig yourself deeper and deeper and deeper. And there has to be, as you say, as you suggest, there has to be a point where it all falls apart. And frankly, I think it, I can't see any other conclusion to the situation. It just gets more and more insane. And I think you're probably right. I think Julian is a very tough nut to crack. I don't think I think he's paying a high price health-wise. I think they're very serious issues. But, it's gone 2 or 3 months now. It's getting crazier every day. I think he'll outlast them.
All right, hang on just 1 second. Hey, guys, here's who sponsors this show. Mike Swanson and his great investment advice at WallStreetWindow.com. He's actually posting some stuff at the Libertarian Institute website now. Really great stuff. The great Mike Swanson. And he's also the author of the book, The War State, which is a really great history of the rise of the new right military-industrial complex after World War II in the Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy eras. You'll really want to look at it. The War State by Mike Swanson. Also, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. If you listen to Mike, you'll be buying some metals. You'll want to buy them from Roberts & Roberts. They've been around as long as I've been alive. They've got a great reputation. They take the very smallest premium possible in order to help arrange the very best sales for you at platinum, palladium, gold, silver, of course, and no premium at all if you buy with Bitcoin. They're at Roberts & Roberts. That's RRBI.co. RRBI.co for your precious metals there. As I mentioned before, Zencash. Zensystem.io to learn all about this great new digital currency, and which is also a secure messaging application and document transfer device and all the rest there. Learn all about it at Zensystem.io and read the book. It's by Hussein Badakhshani. It's How to Run Your Tech Business Like a Libertarian. That's not the title. The title is No Dev, No Ops, No IT. Those are all one word each, if you take my meaning. No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. It's really great. And check out libertystickers.com for all your anti-government propaganda. I made up most of them. And yeah, that didn't work out with the new website I kept promising you. But now supposedly someone else is promising one. So I guess we'll see if we ever get a new website. But there's still a lot of great anti-government propaganda, and you could buy it at libertystickers.com. Now, one more thing. Check out scotthorton.org. We've been having some server problems, but otherwise, scotthorton.org is a great-looking new website, as you can tell. And if you want a good 2018 model website for your business or for whatever you're doing, your opinions, check out expanddesigns.com, the great Harley Abbott over there. And if you go to expanddesigns.com/Scott, you'll save $500. Yeah. Well, I hope so. I mean, when you talk about health problems and stuff, sometimes those things take care of themselves, and he won't be able to withstand it, and would have to submit at some point. And I guess that's what they're banking on. You know, I want to mention here, I'm from time to time reminded, and I keep trying to remind myself, that a great part of the audience of this show is quite young. They were kids during Iraq War II. Barely remember it at all, if at all. And, you know, here it's even from the Obama years, we're living in the future. We're halfway through 2018, and the Manning leak was 8 years ago. So there are a lot of people listening who maybe don't really know much about this at all. But what Manning leaked, and this is, and there are a lot of other things put out by WikiLeaks about a lot of other countries, as we talked about at the beginning. But the Afghan and Iraq war logs and the State Department cables were absolutely full of news stories. I mean, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands. And just the State Department cables alone, there's probably literally, not, you know, exaggerating for effect's sake, but literally there are thousands of newspaper articles around the world that at least in one paragraph say, according to a State Department cable from 2008, blah, 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 and fill in an important part of their story. And that's if the story isn't completely based on some of the information in those documents, and much of which makes our government look absolutely horrible, and all of which we have a right to see. Like, how dare they even keep most of this stuff secret from us in the first place? And, you know, they tried to say it was treason, but none of it was top secret stuff that revealed sources and methods, and we're going to get CIA spies' throats cut out in the field or anything like that. But it was all stuff about this is what your government really does and acts like, how it acts in the world. And then we see with 2016, what's the crime he's accused of doing? Making emails, unadulterated, honest emails from the DNC and the Clinton campaign available for people to look at. They're not saying that he lied or that he selectively leaked only things that made Hillary look bad or anything like that. But we're just supposed to be angry, and we're supposed to assume that they're right and believe them, that the Russians are behind it all somehow anyway. But their accusation is that this guy, he helped whoever show the American people what the Hillary Clinton campaign thinks of them. And that's treason. That's the worst thing he could have ever done, was show people how things really work around here. Doing good journalism, honest journalism. That's what's got them so upset. They don't even, you know, for people who are lacking in the background, a lot of people maybe don't know about this, right? He's not accused of actually hurting America. He's accused of making the empire look really bad.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it in a nutshell. And what people generally miss in all of this is the most essential thing, that, you know, we value our democracy. We pride ourselves on it. We're willing to fight wars for it. But how can democracy be functional in any sense if it's not founded on informed voters? If the voters aren't getting the information they need about what's really going on, their democracy isn't worth anything, because they're just voting in illusions. They're getting cheated. They're going along with lies. And that's what the media is sadly failing, and that means that we're in that dystopic situation. The only reason we're not upset about it most of the time, most people, is because we're not aware of it. And that's the difference that WikiLeaks makes. It's devolved into journalism being like some kind of partisan team sport. And it used to be the case that people and journalists included, and in particular, were very skeptical of what went on in the intelligence community, if that's the right word for it. I personally think that's a sanitizing neologism, intelligence community.
Yeah.
But, you know, we used to be suspicious of the CIA. You know, we used to, but not so much anymore. It's like, you know, whatever official you can quote to back up your political point of view against the other party is valid and is an authority to appeal to.
Yep.
It's just not the way the world should work. Journalism is actually the foundation of a sane and safe society. It's you know, the politicians are supposed to be accountable to the public, but that can only be through adequate journalism.
Yeah,
and not this political partisanship.
Yeah, and back to Assange, is there? You know, you mentioned that this council from Australia came to investigate this kind of thing. Does it look like there's any real movement, or we're pretty much just stuck in wait and see mode here?
We're pretty much stuck in wait and see mode. The Australian government to date hasn't acted in any useful way whatsoever in all these years.
Yeah. Which is not surprising, right?
Yeah. They've been approached before. Perhaps it's different now because the Swedish allegations have gone. There's really nothing at all behind this this insistence that he has to face court for skipping bail. That's just a fig leaf that all this persecution is hanging off. And I think there's a chance that the present Australian government may see that is a real situation that they have to act on and do something about in a diplomatic way, no doubt, in a very quiet way if they do anything at all. But our current Prime Minister does actually have an interesting history. I don't have full knowledge, very deep knowledge of it, but he was actually involved in a case called the Spycatcher case when he was a lawyer, and it did involve, interestingly, analogous situation of somebody being... anyway, I won't embarrass myself by going into much more detail about it, but certainly the current Prime Minister has some grasp of the situation, and John Pilger, a journalist who's very supportive of Assange, very right. close to him, had actually spent quite some time in an interview with Malcolm Turnbull when he was the leader of the opposition, as I recall, at a time when Julian Assange was being basically abandoned by his prime minister at the time, which was Julia Gillard. Mm-hmm. So there's an interesting history here, and there is some chance of an interesting and potentially positive development. But we, as I said in the end of the article, you know, you can't trust these people. You can hope and you can push, and that's about it.
Yeah, certainly you can't trust them. But that is interesting to know that dynamic, though, that when this guy was in the opposition, you're saying, I guess, he was interviewed by Pilger, but you seem to be implying he pretty much got a briefing by Pilger, too, and has no excuse of ignorance here. We know he knows better than all of this, so what's he going to do about it, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, and that was also the case when the current foreign minister at the time, when Julia Gillard was prime minister, the foreign minister was Bob Carr. Mm-hmm. And he had expressed a point of view prior to the situation blowing up. He'd expressed a point of view that was quite sympathetic to Assange and very skeptical about the allegations and so on. But in his role as the foreign minister, he was very standoffish and, very frankly embarrassing and very mm-hmm. unsupportive. But... politics is a strange game. Sometimes things can change, pivot rather dramatically. And this situation is a dramatic situation. And there's been a lot of changes recently. There's a lot of pressure. I think that there will only be increasing public attention. And it's getting harder and harder to spin in the way that it's being spun, in the deceptive and misleading ways that it's been presented so far.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's one hilarious thing about all this. And that is Hillary Clinton hoisted on her own petard after floating. And I guess she and her people would claim she was just joking. But that's even better to me can't we just murder this guy so he's not a problem anymore? And then so apparently this Assange fella took that personally and decided, oh, yeah, lady. On the margin, there were a lot of different things about Hillary that made her lose, but Assange publishing those emails sure didn't help. So I hope he took time to pat himself on the back for that, because I don't know too many people who are happy Trump won, but myself and a lot of other people were sure happy to see Hillary lose. I can tell you that.
My concern with Hillary was actually more focused on the her role in the Libyan war and the Syrian war. And frankly, if Vladimir Putin had something to do with the election, I could only consider that self-defense, because she was rabid about being confrontational towards Russia and about trying to get a no-fly zone in Syria and things like that. She was really escalating everything. Mm-hmm. And she was a real danger. I had no... personally, I was horrified about Trump for a long time and prior to the election. And I wrote a piece in Counterpunch about his endorsement of torture and things like that. But when it came down to the time of the election, I was really thinking that Hillary was worse in terms of the geopolitical situation in and the wars. And Trump had come out as the relative peace candidate. So.
And that's really saying something. Think about that. Isn't that funny? And this is a big part of why she lost, right? Here's a guy who says, not only are we going to kill them, we're going to kill their families. And we're going to torture them. And even if torture doesn't work, I don't care. They deserve it anyway, just as punishment. And he was the relative dove compared to Her Highness, who wanted to expand NATO in Eastern Europe and pick a fight with Russia over Syria, where she'd been involved in supporting al-Qaeda there in the first place when she was still the Secretary of State working with Petraeus on that. So... I mean, yeah, you're right. And that is a big part of how he won, is people thought that he was less worse on the foreign wars. And she ran up until the last minute on, yeah, no fly zone in Syria, and had no idea how much everybody hated hearing that. So, But yeah, I mean, and she did threaten to kill Assange, that like, hey, guys, can't we just kill this guy? He's not an American, right? She was saying maybe she joked about using a drone to do it. But apparently she really meant that. And apparently that stuck in Julian Assange's craw a little bit.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't blame him if it did, absolutely. But their policy is to publish what they get that's in the public interest that hasn't been published before. So, there's still this accusation about him being biased and about him just having a vendetta against Hillary, and that was the only reason why he published that stuff. No, the stuff was published. It was clearly in the public interest. There's an election going on. People need to know about the candidates.
Yeah, so, and he did say, hey, leak me Trump's emails. I'll publish them too.
Absolutely. And, you know, He had that information and he acted on it and he timed it for the greatest impact, which makes sense. That's what the leaker needs, and that's something else which is just generally ignored these days. The whole need for whistleblowing. It's one thing that the press aren't doing their job, but the other thing is that to get the really important information, it has to come from the inside, and that depends on the conscience of individuals, because the checks and balances don't work. The way every institution is set up is to have checks and balances to protect itself.
Mm-hmm.
John Kiriakou had an excellent session on the Unity for Jay vigil. He's the guy who blew the whistle most recently on CIA torture. And he was saying that everybody, he had any experience of this as blowing the whistle out through the internal channels, taken to their superiors, etc. Everybody who tried that ended up marginalized or fired or in jail. And he saw that and realized, well, I'm going to have to go to the press. I'm going to have to get this published. So he went to The Intercept, and they ended up leaking. Well, they did a careless job, which ended up getting him in jail by revealing his identity. Mm. And that subsequently happened to another leaker, Reality Winner, at The Intercept as well. And John was adamant in the interview that WikiLeaks...
Well, it was Matthew Cole. I don't think Cole was at The Intercept when he screwed Kiriakou, but it was the same reporter who later at The Intercept got Reality Winner, so pretty close.
Thanks
but, yeah.
for putting me up on that. I did, I did make a connection, but I had the wrong impression in that case. Yeah.
It was the same reporter, though, so, I mean, you're 90% right.
Yeah, okay. My apologies to The Intercept a little bit, because they did do Reality Winner. And he was adamant. The only thing a whistleblower can do safely is to give the information to WikiLeaks. Now, when you think about it, just zoom back on the situation that he's just described, because he's a guy at the CIA, a massive institution, determining what goes on in America, going around torturing people, and he's saying the only thing we can do about a situation this bad is use this one institution, WikiLeaks. What does that say about the state of the world?
Right.
And the state of journalism.
You know what? There's something we need leaked is the modern day Operation Mockingbird, and get the somewhere there's a manila envelope full of documents about control of the media in our time. And anybody who's read about the Church Committee hearings of the 1970s, it was actually Bernstein from Woodward and Bernstein who wrote a big piece, I guess for Rolling Stone or something, breaking the story about Mockingbird. But William Colby said anyone of any importance in the media is controlled by the agency, full stop. So, and that was then, and supposedly that's illegal, but that's why it's covert action, so that they can get away with it. I mean, I don't think we'd be very surprised, actually, to find out which of our TV stars take their orders straight from Langley. But anyway, on your other point, too, though, Edward Snowden, who leaked the NSA documents, he cited Thomas Tamm and Thomas Drake and Bill Binney and the other... I'm sorry, I forget who I'm leaving out here. I'm terrible for forgetting all of my NSA whistleblowers. I'm sorry?
Jessalyn Radek was one.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, she wasn't NSA, but yeah, she was a famous whistleblower, too. But yeah, and on the William S. Lind, I mean, not William S. Lind, the John Walker Lind case. William S. Lind would be mad at me for that. And so Snowden cited them and said, look what happened. You know, he cited Thomas Drake, I think, specifically, that here was an NSA whistleblower who tried to go through the channels, and they completely nailed him and persecuted him. They didn't say thank you so much for your constructive criticism, you know?
Yeah, you're right.
So that was his reasoning in saying I had no choice but to just give this stuff to Gelman and Greenwald and hit the road and get out of the country.
Yeah. And look, you don't have to have a tinfoil hat on and see this as all just direct oppression from the deep state. Sadly, the most effective part of this, ironically, people are talking a lot now with all this Russiagate stuff about useful idiots, that people that are acting in their own, according to their own view of how things are going, and they're just doing what they think is right, but they're really helping the enemy. Well, sadly, that's actually what's going on, I think, mainly amongst journalists. It's not, most of them at least aren't getting orders from Langley. Most of them just are buying into what I call media virtual reality. It's systematic illusion of ignoring real investigative journalism and the output of WikiLeaks, for instance, and just listening to what each other is saying, and confirmation bias, basically. Jonathan Cook has an excellent article of this in Counterpunch in the weekend edition. I think it's called How Corporate...
How Corporate Media... Something about their narrative. Yeah, we ran it at antiwar.com too.
Okay, How Corporate Media Enslaves Us to a World of Illusions.
Yeah, there you go.
And he emphasizes that, look, it's not that some people claim to be able to see through everything, and unlike the great unwashed masses of sheep who just believe everything they're told. That's not how it works. What happens is that there is this virtual reality that the media spin themselves in with narratives like a cocoon. And the reason why he knows that is that he's run up against it. He's run up against the limits of it in hard factual ways, and that's what wakes people up, is when something like that happens to them, when they know what the story's supposed to be, and they know from some other reasons just how it really is. That happened to me personally in during the Iraq War. All the noise about Saddam having to give account of his weapons program, he supplied a great volume of information, and as soon as he did that, I see Rumsfeld on TV, Donald Rumsfeld, just laugh at it.
Yeah. Well, to this day, they say, well, Saddam was pretending to have weapons of mass destruction to scare Iran. Well, really? Because he gave up a 12,000-page dossier saying, here is every I dotted and T crossed. I got nothing, I swear to God. That's some pretension there, huh? And then, as you said, they just ignored it. They just laughed about it, and so they didn't even have to deal with it.
Yeah, and this is what really brought home to me that we live in this virtual media virtual reality, because the function of the press is to hold that kind of crap to account. If a politician laughs after saying, after spending months saying, look, you've got to do this, you've got to do this, or we're going to go in there and nuke you, and he does it, he gives them the 12,000 pages, then they've got to take it seriously, right?
Guess not. Boy, you know what? I'm glad you remember 2002 the way I do, because wasn't that something?
Yeah, so it sounds like the same thing happened to you. You know, we ran up against the limits of media virtual reality.
Absolutely.
The illusion.
But you know, my favorite
I really recommend to anybody, especially younger folks like you mentioned, who don't have this kind of experience, that haven't hit that wall yet, read that article. It'll be really helpful.
Yeah. You know, the one I can never forget was, because it was a top headline on antiwar.com, it was actually from like page 43 of the Washington Post. But on antiwar.com, in the other virtual reality of the internet there, where Eric can rank the news stories in whatever order he wants, it was one of the top stories of the day. That, guess what? All the nuclear experts say that the aluminum tubes couldn't possibly be used for centrifuges. Not like they have a Manhattan Project where they could spin a single centrifuge anywhere in Iraq anyway. But these are for rockets, for Katusha-type rockets that you shoot out of the back of your pickup truck. Give us a break. This is not nuclear or anything. And that was in September of 2002. And so it was like, ta-da, symbols crash. Holy crap, there you go. The Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the State Department and the Department of Energy experts, the actual experts, say, psh, give me a break. These aluminum tubes are for rockets, not centrifuges. And then it didn't matter. The New York Times and the Washington Post itself and the entire political class and everyone on TV, they all just pretended that that article never existed, that they'd never heard of this. And then when Bush talks about aluminum tubes the day after tomorrow, nobody says, yeah, but the Washington Post debunked that. Nobody objects. And on the Sunday morning news shows, they go, yeah, aluminum tubes. And then they just keep going with the narrative after it's been debunked as debunked could be by the government itself. They had one guy at CIA who insisted it was so to get himself a promotion, and they had the cabinet that was pretending to believe it because they wanted to. And, I mean, you can't get any more blatant than that one. You know what I mean? I mean, the people who testified against it to the Post were on the record with their names, you know, lifelong Department of Energy nuclear experts and stuff. Just,
yeah,
man. Anyway. I'm sorry, we're just having fun talking now, but...
No, I mean, you're right on the point. This is what needs to be realized. It's like the press is the health of society, and it's just not healthy. It's really unhealthy, and this is what people need to realize by whatever means they can.
Yeah.
2008, I had a similar experience with... John McCain claiming that Georgia was attacked without provocation by Russia.
Yeah.
The day of the ceremony of the Beijing Olympics, right? I heard that on that particular day when he made that claim. The day after, I heard by a news publication that there had been an artillery attack from Georgia on South Ossetia. And nobody ever called McCain on that.
Yep. In fact,
these are the people running the world, and I'm just a guy watching the internet, seeing the information. I already know this guy's talking complete crap because of what I heard yesterday.
Right. Yeah. Now I don't know about the international dateline and all this. You're in Australia, and I can never get my head around the time zones there. But I know that, you know, from here, Eastern Europe is, you know, basically half a day ahead or whatever. So what was in the middle of the night there was kind of in the middle of the day here, and so we all just saw the entire story unfolding live before our eyes. There was no question about who started it. There's no question that Saakashvili had attacked even the Russian peacekeepers in South Ossetia who were there under a deal with the EU. There was no question about that. And then not only, I'm sorry, I'm just adding to all your wonderful anecdotes here. Not only did McCain get away with pushing that, but there was a debate with him and Obama that was hosted by Tom Brokaw of NBC News. And McCain made the completely ridiculous false claim that Russia had launched this aggressive war against Georgia for no reason. And he looks at Brokaw, and Brokaw stops and kind of looks at Obama, and he looks back at McCain, and they basically all just look at each other and agree silently that, okay, we're just going to go with that. And then they just go on. But you can see the body language just as plain as day. That like, oh, remember we talked about this. We're going to pretend this bullshit, right? You're not going to contradict him, are you, Obama? Okay, good. Go ahead then, Mr. McCain. And then it just is amazing to see. And that's the kind of thing that could get humanity dead, right? Is lies about what Russia's military is doing and why at any given point. That can have major consequences.
Absolutely. Man. And it's gone to the state now where, you know, we're seeing Trump, you know, the relative peace candidate, has already launched two sets of missile strikes into Syria, motivated by nothing but a picture of a child doused in water, a healthy child doused in water, as if they were the victim of a gas attack.
Yep.
It's like that's all it takes now to unleash a bunch of weapons.
And he's really, he's escalated the war in Afghanistan by thousands of troops, and he's taken the gloves off, as they say, and relaxed all the rules when it comes to the drone wars and special operations forces on the ground in Iraq, Syria, and especially in Yemen, Somalia. He's got a drone war going in Libya right now. There's a brand new report out about the civilian casualties from that. So he's really escalating all the terror wars. I mean, he actually stopped the CIA support for Al-Qaeda in Syria. That was good. But otherwise, he's been an absolute disaster.
And, you know, at the same time, we're getting reports about, for instance, how he wanted to pull troops out of Syria and was, you know, slapped across the knuckles by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. You know, imagine what it would be like if this was Hillary in charge.
I know, man. Well, I mean, Ayman al-Zawahiri would be sitting on the throne in Damascus for one thing, right?
Yeah.
Jesus. All right. Hey, listen, Simon, this has been great talking with you. I really appreciate you sticking up for Assange. I really, you know, I talked with him back in 2010 or something. I should have been doing a better job of covering this story myself. So I appreciate you helping me pick up the slack here, too.
Oh, look, thanks for having me on. I'm glad that, you know, I'm not alone as a voice in this regard myself. So I think you're doing a great job, man.
All right. Well, thanks again for coming on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott. See ya.
Okay, guys, that's Dr. Simon Floth. He is an Australian analytical philosopher and an early contributor to WikiLeaks. You can find his article at antiwar.com. It's called Assange's Ecuadorian Cave, and it's from June 16th, 2018. All right, you guys, and that's the show. You know me, scotthorton.org, youtube.com/scotthortonshow, libertarianinstitute.org, and buy my book, and it's now available in audiobook as well, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. Hey, it's endorsed by Ron Paul and Daniel Ellsberg and Stephen Walt and Peter Van Buren and Matthew Ho and Daniel Davis and Anand Gopal and Patrick Coburn and Eric Margolies. You'll like it. Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. And follow me on Twitter @ Scott Horton Show. Thanks, guys.